We'll hear the last related matter, which is, I'm not sure who the named appellant is, but it's either National Fire Insurance or Motor Vehicle Casualty v. Thorpe.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, David Christian on behalf of Continental Insurance Company and National Fire Insurance Company of Hartford. I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal, if it please the Court, and I want to indicate at the outset, Mr. Schiavone, who represents some of our co-appellants, may take some or all of that time on behalf of his client's separate interests. Your Honors,
the total time.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The Third Circuit's en banc decision in the GIT case, Global Industrial Technologies, indicates that we should have had bankruptcy court standing under Section 1109B of the Bankruptcy Code. Rather, what happened in the courts below in this case is that we were preempted and at the same time denied bankruptcy court standing. Normally, if you're to be preempted, you would have standing, obviously, to complain about that and to make a record about it, and the court would take evidence and hear from you in order to decide what of your arguments might be preempted and what are not preempted on the facts of that case. The court may wonder, why is it we care to have bankruptcy court standing to contest confirmation of the Chapter 11 plan in this case? Well, one thing we know from the record is that in the 30 years prior to commencement of the Chapter 11 case, my client and other insurers paid $180 million, all of our aggregate limits of liability, to indemnify Thorpe for asbestos-related claims. Upon confirmation of the Chapter 11 plan in this case, the debtor now has $600 million in settlements or promises to pay from the settled insurance companies, the same insurance companies that have paid a portion of that $180 million for the 30 years prior. Why is it that $180 million over 30 years turned into $600 million from already exhausted carriers in the context of this Chapter 11 case? Well, part of the reason is the allegation being pursued through the Chapter 11 plan is that we have potentially unlimited liability that we pay forever. And if I can use this metaphor, the plan was sort of the ringing of the dinner bell and encouraged the filing of claims. Now, that's our litigation position, obviously. We understand the debtor and other proponents of this plan contest that. But the point is, the bankruptcy court should have heard from us on that issue, should have permitted us discovery into our allegations, and conducted an evidentiary hearing. Rather, when confronted with arguments about the potential harm to my clients and the other carriers by the Chapter 11 plan, the bankruptcy court remarked as follows: I don't know, and I don't care to find out. That failure of inquiry is an error in this case that permeates the Chapter 11 plan confirmation proceeding.
There's some dispute about whether or not you were in a position where you could have pursued discovery. I mean, I think there's, in the record, there's some reference to the fact that the judge said, I didn't preclude you from taking discovery.
The judge struck six of our experts who came to court for the confirmation hearing, several of which were going to testify about the harm occasioned on us by the Chapter 11 plan.
Well, that's by the time you got to the confirmation hearing. But before that, were you precluded from doing discovery?
Yes, Your Honor. The bankruptcy court on repeated occasions ordered us not to pursue discovery. We submitted detailed discovery requests that were at various times quashed or subject to protective orders. The record is voluminous, I understand, but it's also quite clear that we were denied discovery and denied bankruptcy court standing. We were denied standing to contest confirmation of the plan, notwithstanding being parties of an interest under Section 1109B of the Bankruptcy Code. The Third Circuit en banc panel in GIT analyzed this completely correctly in saying, if you're the pockets who are sought to be picked, you have at least bankruptcy court standing to challenge the picking of your pockets. The same is true here. Now, there's an attempt by the appellees to distinguish GIT by saying, well, in that case, it was Silica, a different mass tort, and in that case, the evidence was that the claims making increased 27 times over the debtor's pre-petition experience. Well, setting aside that Silica is a relatively new tort on the scene compared to asbestos, they are both mass torts, and we have a similar set of circumstances here where we allege there was improper collusion that goes to the good faith of the plan, where we allege that the liability blossomed, that the procedures promulgated with the agreement of the debtor and the claimant's counsel are lax criteria and inflated payments that are going to inflate the potential indemnification claims against my clients. So while it may not be 27 times and they may not be Silica claims, it's completely analogous. Your Honors, another important point.
Counsel, I've got a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that we adopted the position of the Third Circuit and said you had bankruptcy standing and should have had a fair shake in challenging the plan. And assuming we said that, then what happens then if we send it back? Are your clients able to totally undo the plan that has already been consummated in part? Or, in other words, what's the nature of the bankruptcy court hearing if we give you relief?
Judge Gould, I think the court has two options in that regard, and both we think would provide effective relief. One option is to reverse plan confirmation. There's a suggestion of equitable mootness in this case, but we think this is sort of the last case for equitable mootness because all the parties are before the court. They decided to waive the condition to confirmation, that the confirmation order be non-appealable in order, as a tactical maneuver, in order to increase the likelihood of an equitable mootness finding. And moreover, as a practical matter, there's a payment percentage of 17.5% in this case and $600 million in settlements. By adjusting the payment percentage following through on the settlements, perhaps under another Chapter 11 plan that complied with the law, there's no issue of disgorgement or practical difficulties in this case. All the parties are before the court, and the court can fashion effective relief. If the court doesn't wish to reverse confirmation, another effective, albeit incomplete, remedy is to declare that we are not preempted. One of the things we object to about this plan is a broad preemption ruling, literally unprecedented in the other asbestos-related Chapter 11 cases, that will be used as a sword against us in our post-confirmation litigation with the Section 524G Trust. The court could declare that because we didn't get our day in court, we didn't have an opportunity for the discovery, and we didn't have an opportunity to make our arguments about why the plan shouldn't be confirmed, then we should not be preempted by that plan. And that's a remedy that could be tailored to the facts and circumstances of this case. And my client, for one, would be satisfied with having, when we get our day in court in the coverage litigation in L.A. Superior Court, to have the debtor or the trust as its successor make whatever arguments they want to make, and we not have our hand tied behind our back by a preemption ruling, and get to make whatever defenses and arguments that we want to make, unfettered by what went on in a bankruptcy proceeding where we were denied standing.
Can we go back for a moment to your statement about this is the last case where equitable mootness might apply? Can't we take some notice of the fact that the plan is being implemented, and you made an effort to have that stayed in the district court, the Court of Appeals, mm-hmm. and Justice Kennedy is our circuit justice. Mm-hmm. Can't we glean from that some determination, if you will, that it's you had your day, you tried, and it didn't succeed, and now implementation is on its way, if not already.
Judge Seaborg, there are two lines of cases in this circuit about equitable mootness. One is the Roberts Farm line of cases that use equitable mootness as a sanction for not diligently appealing or pursuing your rights and remedies. And really, that's the origin of the equitable mootness doctrine. This is a sanction for a litigant who sits on his rights. We didn't do that. If anything, we were criticized for being overzealous. So that line of cases is inapplicable here. There's a second line of cases, illustrated best by the Baker and Drake case from this circuit, which recognizes even if you don't obtain a stay pending appeal, that's not a reason to bar the courthouse door to the merits that the appellant is complaining of.
No, but I guess what I see from your briefs is this sort of suggestion that your counterparts are acting in undue haste. They're trying to thwart your rights by rushing implementation. And that argument doesn't have a lot of resonance when you haven't been obstructed in your efforts to stop it and you've not succeeded.
Well, except, Your Honor, we were denied bankruptcy court standing and we were preempted by the plan. If that's not thwarting us, I don't know what is. And it's true, and I don't mean to cast aspersions at counsel in saying this. I think it's good lawyering on their part that they consciously made the litigation tactical decision to waive the condition to confirmation, that there be no further appeals of plan confirmation, and to substantially consummate the plan as an effort to create equitable mootness. And look, they're all before the court, and if they lose in pursuing that litigation tactic, there's always a disappointed litigant. Judge Schroeder,
do you have... I'm not sure that answers the Judge Seaborg's question about... The the concomitant to the ability to appeal is the ability to seek a stay in order to keep the status quo. And if you lose that, we see this in all kinds of contexts.
Sure.
You may have lost the opportunity to get meaningful relief.
Well, to be clear, Judge Schroeder, equitable mootness is not actual mootness.
I understand.
Right? So the court can fashion relief. It's the question of whether the court wants to use its power to fashion relief. And what we're suggesting here is, you know, the advocates on the other side who are all before the court have made the decision to pursue perhaps a risky strategy to push the envelope, and so it's a bad, the equities do not favor them in applying equitable mootness. So it's not actually moot, and it would be inequitable to imply the doctrine here. And we think
here it would be, yes, you're saying here it would be inequitable mootness.
Indeed, Your Honor. I agree with Judge Gould that it would be inequitable in these facts. What's more, just as a practical matter, because there's a payment percentage, because there are $600 million in settlements, because reversal does not mean there won't be a Chapter 11 plan and a trust in this case, it just means we'll have our day in court and maybe a plan would be confirmed that's more consistent with the requirements of the law, there's not a practical obstacle. Compare this to the Baker and Drake case, where you had, I think it was hundreds of taxicab medallion holders who'd gone through all sorts of exercises to reincorporate or relicense themselves, and the court said, nonetheless, we're going to reach the merits. We're not going to let equitable mootness be a bar to the inquiry on the merits of the case, and that's what should happen here. That's particularly true because we're talking about a debtor that had no operations for the 3 years prior to bankruptcy. It had previously divested itself of all of its valuable assets. The old equity in this case is making money under this Chapter 11 plan. This is just the kind of case where in equity the court ought to reach the merits rather than barring the courthouse door. I guess what I'd like to say, one other point before I sit down and reserve time for rebuttal, is that you're going to hear from opposing counsel, I predict, that this plan is insurance neutral and doesn't prejudice us at all. Well, first of all, we were preempted. So if that isn't prejudice, I don't know what is. And we know the bankruptcy court gave a broad construction of preemption in the context of our claim appeal, because the bankruptcy court said it had preemption applied to anything pre-petition having to do with the plan, and that went back to 2003 when the debtor had different lawyers and the plan was not even a glimmer in the debtor's eye.
As an insurer, you have a coverage dispute, and you're going to be able, that's carved out as I understand it, and you can go ahead and litigate that in the state superior court. So,
except
how
Judge Seabrook,
is
we're preempted.
Pardon?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
no,
you, Your
ahead.
Honor. Except that we're preempted. We're going to face an argument that some of our discovery in the state court action and some of our arguments in the state court action are off limits because of what Judge Bluban did. And we know Judge Bluban gave her preemption ruling a broad construction from the context of our claim appeal. What's more, we know that the quote-unquote insurance neutrality in this plan is insurance neutrality in label only. It is riddled with exceptions. And I get that phrase, riddled with exceptions, from Judge Judith Fitzgerald, who authored the original insurance neutrality language from the combustion engineering case. She uttered those words in the context of denying confirmation to a Chapter 11 plan in the Pittsburgh Corning case that was labeled insurance neutral like this one, but like this one was riddled with exceptions. And I'd refer, Your Honors, to the exceptions from the preservation of asbestos insurance defenses, and they can be read quite broadly. I'll just pick out two, and then I'll reserve the balance of my time. One is any defense that was released, waived, altered, or otherwise resolved. The debtor, will surely argue that some of our defenses and arguments were altered or otherwise resolved by this Chapter 11 plan. Number four on that list is premised on the commencement of the cases. Well, we know from Judge Bluban's rulings in the context of our claim appeal that commencement of the cases in her mind reaches back to years prior to the filing of bankruptcy when no plan had been formulated, and it's not clear that the debtor had even considered filing a Chapter 11 case. And so this plan is not insurance neutral. At the same time, it preempts our defenses, and yet we didn't have bankruptcy court standing as parties in interest to contest it or to conduct discovery. So for that reason, it ought to be reversed, or as a lesser but somewhat effective relief, at least a declaration that because we didn't get our day in court in bankruptcy court, we shouldn't be preempted by the results thereof. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. My name is Tom Patterson, and I and my firm have served as Thorpe's appellate counsel through the 30-odd appeals that these appellants have brought in the last 3.5 years in this bankruptcy case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for Mr. Lockwood, who represents the Asbestos Claimants Committee. He may or may not choose to address the Court, and I understand I'm the one responsible for coming up with those 3 minutes, so I will endeavor to honor Mr. Lockwood's request. Your Honor, we are in the odd position of someone who is claiming they're harmed by something that doesn't harm them, and so I'm in the position, I guess, of denying that someone who thinks they're harmed was harmed. But let's just start where things more or less ended, with Mr. Christian's concern that broad preemption or broad defenses in the plan could be used elsewhere in the coverage court to impair their rights. And in particular, he referred to one of the asbestos insurance defenses that is waived. And I'm now in the plan, Your Honor, section 1.12, and I'll give the Court a record site. I may not have a pin site, but I can get the plan for you. The plan is at ER 10 at page 110. And section 1.12, the language that Mr. Christian started to read, is a defense that has been released, waived, altered, or otherwise resolved in full or in part. And the language that he ran out of time before he could say is, in any asbestos insurance settlement or in any other agreement with an asbestos insurer. In other words, the provision that he complains of is one that has no application to him because they did not enter into an asbestos insurance settlement. The purpose of the waiver is simply to ensure that what an insurer waives in an agreement stays waived. And I think if the Court reads the four defenses that are expressly preserved in section 1.12d, A through D, the Court will find that these are clear of fairly routine application and are certainly not such that they are amenable to manipulation down the road. Let me turn to GIT for a minute, because standing is a big issue here, and then I want to turn to the manner in which they say they're harmed. GIT is a rather extraordinary case. It's a 6-4 opinion from the Third Circuit. And in bringing the Court's attention to that opinion, the appellants neglected to provide the Court with the powerful dissent from four judges. And so I urge the Court, if it reads the decision, also to read the dissent. But even the 6-judge majority is perfectly consistent with what happened here, because the Third Circuit in GIT was very careful to distinguish what had happened in GIT from what happened in combustion engineering. And in combustion engineering, the Court recognized that a plan could be insurance neutral, and if a plan is insurance neutral, then insurers lack standing with respect to the broad application or the broad requirements for confirmation. What an insurer always has standing with respect to, and what Mr. Christian is incorrect in saying that his client was denied standing but was nevertheless preempted, in combustion engineering, as in Thorpe, the insurers were granted full standing with respect to whether or not the plan was insurance neutral and to the manner in which the plan affected them. There were two ways in which the plan affected them broadly. The first was that, as initially drafted, the plan cut off their contribution rights and did not provide a mechanism for either their compensation or determination of their fairness. And the bankruptcy judge at the first confirmation hearing, January 8 and 9, 2009, said, no, you plan proponents, you have a homework assignment. You have to prove to me that those contributions from the insurers are fair such that there aren't contribution claims, or you have to provide a mechanism to compensate them, judgment reduction or so forth. And they won on that issue. They made the argument. The judge said, you win. We had to modify the plan. The second issue was with what we refer to as the transfer issue, and that is that the plan vests the insurance policy proceeds in a trust as required by 524G. 524G says you have to put the assets in a trust, have to use the assets to pay claimants. And they were given standing to argue that. They argued it in the bankruptcy court. They argued it in the district court. They argue it here. And no one ever said that you don't have standing to argue this. And similarly, if there were other preemption issues, and they sort of allude to them, but they don't really say what they are, of course they have standing to the extent they're preempted. I can't see how anyone would deny that. What they wanted and what they latch on to GIT for is they want standing not to argue how the plan affected them, but they want to compel the debtors to go through a long song and dance of discovery, a long song and dance of trial, in order to prove up all of the multifarious base requirements for confirmation of a plan of reorganization. They want the standing that a creditor would have, but they're not creditors. And what combustion engineering teaches is that if the plan is broadly insurance neutral, they don't get that broad standing. GIT says, in a special circumstance, they can get that broad standing. And what is that special circumstance? That special circumstance is when the plan itself radically changes the nature of the insurer's liability. And the court was careful to say, by the way, that in combustion engineering, the effect of the plan was to increase the claims filed by many thousand. But the court said, but combustion engineering, that does not amount to a change in the quantum of liability. We know combustion engineering had decades of asbestos liability. A few more claims here or there is not material. But what GIT said is that here, the plan created liability. It increased the liability for silica claims by 27 times. And that change in the quantum of liability is what gives standing to the insurers in that case. That, and it appeared from the record, I think the court even said that the charge of improper conduct was, quote, not without support in the record. Love double negatives. But there's no such implication here, Your Honor. I mean, no one would dispute that in this case, Thorpe had thousands of asbestos claims. Mr. Christian alluded to the $180 million that his clients and others paid in loss and indemnity. No one denies that Thorpe has continuing ongoing liability in the many thousands of claims that existed at the time of the filing. No one would deny that the trust has been created by consensual settlements with the asbestos claimants, with the futures representative, with 17 insurers who agreed to kick in $600 million, hardly a nuisance settlement. No one would deny that the trust is using its money to pay claims. It's paid, I think, around $15 million worth so far to hundreds of creditors to this point. And that the plan created a vehicle that broadly preserved the defenses to coverage that the non-settling insurers had and allowed them to go back to state court. Now, arguably, the bankruptcy court could have taken a different route. The bankruptcy court could have said, and I think this is actually one of the suggestions that Continental makes in their reply brief, that the bankruptcy court could have said, no, I'm going to determine these coverage defenses, and then we'll find out where we are. But that's not an insurance-neutral plan, and the case law teaches that it is permissible to have an insurance-neutral plan. And return the litigation to the state court. No one would deny that the plan facilitated Thorpe and Pacific's ability to reorganize, keep employing people, keep in business, operate as a functioning economic player, and that this was all done within the four corners of the only mechanism that exists at law for anybody to obtain true peace in asbestos, 524G. Only way to cut off indirect asbestos claims, only way to cut off future claims, and probably the only way to effectively cut off direct claims to the extent they exist under state law. Now, let's go back to combustion engineering for a minute, because there's a very important aspect of this case. Because the appellants like to always put in their briefs that, well, why don't you just give us what there was in combustion engineering, you know, the nothing herein, the so-called super peremptory provision. But there was also a tandem provision. And it's in the decision, I think, at about page 218. There was a tandem provision that was introduced in the plan and the orders. And that tandem provision said that although nothing in the plan affects you, it also said that nothing in the bankruptcy would affect the rights and claims of either the debtor or the insurers. And this is the essence of insurance neutrality. Insurance neutrality says, what's the before picture? And what's the after picture? And what goes on in between during the bankruptcy case shouldn't enhance rights, and it shouldn't diminish the debtor's rights to insurance. And that's what combustion engineering recognized, and that's effectively what has happened here, Your Honor.
So in your view, what is it that they want, your opponent wants discovery to establish that it's not entitled to establish?
I think what they want is they want discovery with respect to the foundational requirements for 524G relief. In other words, discovery relating to the manner in which the plan was negotiated. I think good faith is one of the main categories they use. It's sort of a, but that's sort of a, a catch-all requirement.
So in your view, they want to overturn the whole thing?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and in fact, Your Honor, I take them at their word. Continental, in its reply brief, says that points out, you know, that the district court said, you know, well, what are your alternatives to this vesting in the trust? What, you know, if there's another way to do it, then maybe we won't preempt it. And she says, well, basically they said they gave three ways of saying Thorpe shouldn't be reorganized at all. And they give those three ways in their brief. They're honest about it. And they say, well, maybe that's right. Maybe Thorpe shouldn't be reorganized. And I think, you know, that's what they want. But, you know, it's very clear to us that within the four corners of 524G, we've ticked the boxes. And under Sylmar, the Ninth Circuit's good faith
case. They also say there are defects in terms of the debtor's contribution, that it's illusory, effectively. Don't they make that argument?
Well, they do, Your Honor. But let's go to that for a minute. It's not unusual to have offsetting or countervailing claims. So let's start first with what the debtors and the related parties are doing. The debtors and the related parties are kicking in $500,000 from Far West and the two notes from the reorganized debtor. One has been effectively offset at this point by virtue of countervailing claims. The other one will be due over a period of years. They also contributed their rights to recovery from the Manville Trust, which had a 5% dividend on account of, you know, indemnity claims against Manville, which was the manufacturer of this god-awful stuff, is worth many millions of dollars. So what is the debtor getting? Well, let's start first with what the debtor gave. The debtor contended that it had bad faith claims against its insurers for, it doesn't matter what for. They had bad faith claims. Those claims were personal to the debtors, if you will. Those are not indemnity claims. Those are for harm to the business to the debtor. And those claims were something of value to it. And so the debtor, in negotiating with its asbestos creditors, said, well, this is something that is mine, the debtor, and I don't want to give it to the trust. And, you know, there was back and forth. And ultimately it was negotiated that the debtor got to keep, I believe, 2% down on a sliding scale of overall insurance recoveries, representing its negotiated share of the bad faith claims. So that is the $5 million or so dollars that the debtor reserved for itself that had the effect of diminishing the effect of some of the contributions it was otherwise making. But I think if you look at the contribution of the Manville Trust rights, you know, the debtor is still making a greater contribution, first. And second, if you look at the case law, you know, much of the case law is in, you know, sort of disarray on this, but some of the case law, and I think Quigley is a case, says that the contribution of insurance rights may be sufficient. I apologize, it's not Quigley. But there are cases that say that contribution of the insurance rights may be sufficient in and of itself. And this debtor undisputably gave $600 million of settled insurance rights, as well as turning over, you know, whatever claims exist against our obstreperous friends on the other side of the aisle. So I think at the end of the day, Your Honor, the insurers are not asking here for neutrality. What they're asking for is, in effect, a predetermination that they have rights that should be recognized. And let's sort of take a look at a couple of them. Some of them broadly fall under the category of what I'll call cooperation. This is the concern that post-confirmation, post-effective date, the trust will not be a friendly policyholder to their insurer and not comply or live up to the obligations under the policies. Well, there are two answers to this. First, the trust has undertaken that obligation under the plan, and it couldn't be clearer. It's section 5.4.1, and it says that they undertake the obligations, assume the obligations under the policies. Now, you could say, well, maybe they won't. Well, if they don't, then it creates whatever coverage defense exists under applicable law. So the trust has a risk if it wants to fool around with this, and whatever the letter of or spirit or whatever the requirement is as a matter of state law to live up to those policies, it has to live up to. They say, well, but a trust isn't really very good. What if I need whatever the state law equivalent is of a 30B6 witness? What if I need a representative of Thorpe? Well, the answer is that the very same section that I alluded to, section 5.4.1, makes clear that Thorpe's obligations are not exonerated by virtue of this. Thorpe has whatever ongoing obligations it otherwise has. And if you say, well, what incentive does Thorpe have? I would suggest that if Thorpe blew off its obligations and gave rise to a coverage defense, that the trust may rotate its guns and come knocking on Thorpe's door. So I think Thorpe has every economic incentive to live up to that obligation. And there isn't a shred of evidence or a shred of reason to think that these individuals and entities won't live up to their obligation. They have every economic incentive to do so. I also want to deal with, I'd say it's an argument, but it's really more of a slogan than an argument, that the trust is, quote, claimant controlled. Well, the trust has two, now three, independent trustees. One of them was one of Thorpe's former coverage counsel. And these trustees have full fiduciary power to exercise their rights and obligations and powers under the trust. There is also something called the Trust Advisory Committee, which is some claimants' lawyers. And there's a futures representative who represents the futures claim. And there are certain things that the trustees cannot do without the consent of the either the TAC or the futures or both. And I think this is where the claimant-controlled allegation comes from. But the trust has an out. Both in Section 5.8 and 6.6 of the trust agreement, it says if the TAC or the futures won't give their consent to something that the trustees think is fiduciarily required, the trustees are authorized to go to court and let a court decide. So in all respects, they have unfettered ability to go to a court and say, you know, we're being asked to do something or we're being constrained from doing something that we think is inconsistent with our obligations or duties, and we want the court to clarify that.
What court would they go to?
At present, Your Honor, the bankruptcy court has ongoing administration oversight over the trust.
How long is that provided in the agreement? Is that how long does that exist for the duration of the administration of the trust?
Your Honor, in a sense, I don't know, because I would think at some point or with respect to some issues, it could well be that the bankruptcy court would lack jurisdiction. And I think that's what sort of happens, is the jurisdiction tails off. But there's no express time constraint on the exercise of that power.
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt your answer to Judge Schroeder.
No, that's fine.
But you had said you wanted to leave 7 minutes for your colleague.
Thank you, Judge Gould. I actually said three, and I see I'm down to that. But just before, and Mr. Lockwood will forgive me if I use 45 seconds, because I do want to talk about mootness for just a second. Again, I think we sort of start with a disagreement over the facts. Not all of the parties necessary to this appeal or necessary to a mootness determination are before this court. The settling insurers are not before this court. They contributed $135 million in express reliance on the issuance of the injunctions. They are not before this court. And if they lose the benefit of those injunctions, to be sure they have, you know, various provisions that ameliorate the effect, but those injunctions is the gold that they paid for, because that's what protects them from contribution claims. That's what protects them from direct actions. That's what protects them from the future claims. Second, the asbestos claimants are not before this court. There's an asbestos claims representative, but the claimants who voted on a plan that said that these rights will vest in a trust are not before this court. And I would submit, Your Honor, that it would be inequitable to overturn the plan or give the piecemeal relief sought under the current circumstances. I'll just end with a thought that...
How does that relate to equitable mootness?
Well, those entities are not before the court, and they relied on the plan. And the case law says that when not all the necessary parties are before the court, then mootness may be required. And I'll just end with one last thought that arose a little bit in the prior colloquy. It comes from the Continental Airlines case in the Third Circuit, its first significant case on mootness. And that is that the question isn't whether those who obtained the order confirming the plan acted reasonably in relying on it, because there was a valid unstayed court order. There were claimants who had gone unpaid since 2005. There was a need to get a loan in place. There was a need to get out of bankruptcy so the companies could operate. Obviously, bankruptcy didn't enhance its operations. There were business purposes to consummate and go forward. The question is not whether that was reasonable. That question was answered when all of the courts that were faced with the issue denied the stay. Thank you.
You've left to your colleague 30 seconds.
I'll hear about it.
Very briefly, Your Honor. Both the JIT case and the standing issue in this case have been misstated by counsel for the insurers. The JIT case involved, among other things, an assignment of insurance by the objecting insurers to the Silica Trust, and Mr. Christian's clients that he says with a broad preemption ruling that you can look at my claims, that client weren't being assigned to the trust, and the preemption ruling that he was discussing in that case has nothing to do with the preemption issues that they were denied coverage on. As Mr. Patterson pointed out, they were given standing on an issue-by-issue basis. The JIT case doesn't even discuss issue-by-issue standing, which this court is fully familiar with and its precedents sustain. And the point here is that my constituency, creditors in this case, who are the only parties that have claims against the trust, made a deal, which they claim they were denied discovery of, but which is clear on the face of the plan, to accept certain trade-offs with the debtor in exchange for providing the consideration, including insurance, to the trust. The insurers here have no claims against that trust. They are utterly unaffected by whether they get less or more. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Your Honors. Tancred Schiavone for Whittle Melvin and Myers for Appellants Cal Union, Motor Vehicle Casualty, and Central National Insurance Company. Judge Seaborg, you asked my colleague a question about whether there was some dispute in the record about whether the discovery had been sought, opportunities had been sought. I think respectfully you may have confused the two appeals. On the proof of claim appeal that Continental had, there was a dispute about whether or not they had fairly had an opportunity to take discovery or not. On the confirmation appeal, this appeal, there is no dispute on that issue. And the order I would point, Your Honors, to is in tab 24 of our appendix, where Judge Blumon says categorically she prohibits all discovery except the serving of contention interrogatories. In or close to that, she also quashed 25 subpoenas that we served for fact witnesses that we were going to bring to the confirmation hearing. Shortly thereafter, or at the confirmation hearing, we brought, I think, 7, maybe 8 expert witnesses, including Professor Jeffrey Hazard, Professor Harrington from the University of Chicago, and a series of other very, very prominent experts, each one going to different areas of the plan where we felt our rights were impaired in one way or another. The record at the end of the day on this appeal, the evidentiary record, I know I myself, I had delivered to me 3 weeks ago the record so I could study it to get ready for this. It's some things you have to see really to understand. The entire evidentiary record that supports this multi-hundred-million-dollar plan comes down to 2 affidavits. One is found in tab 27 of the appellee's record. It's at tab 27, S-E-R 1102. That's Mr. Renfrew's declaration. It's 9 pages. The other one is the gentleman who walks away and makes a tremendous profit from this case, Mr. Fulks. It's tab 86, ER 1409. 9 pages.
Of course, though, the paucity of the evidentiary record doesn't mean you have standing.
That's true. That's true, Your Honor. But the point here to be made, we weren't given an opportunity to cross on these.
Right.
This entire
that
plan,
all assumes you have standing to do that, right?
That's right. We came to that evidentiary hearing, or what was supposed to be an evidentiary hearing, with the desire to want to put on evidence about what how our rights were impaired by this plan. Specifically on the motion to quash, we said the fact witnesses we were calling were being called so we could present evidence to show how our risks were increased and how our burdens were also increased by this plan. It was all quashed. The entire set of findings about how we don't have any rights here is supported by these 2 little affidavits. How the preemption rulings are all supported by the 2 affidavits. All the rulings about the extraordinary channeling injunction meeting the requirements of the code, the propriety of the contributions, all the requirements of 1129 of good faith, they're all supported by 2 affidavits that were not subject to any cross. Your Honor, if we had had an opportunity to put on a case, I know it's hard when you sort of look at these provisions. One thing you could do is compare the CE and GE super peremptory clause that says it preserves our rights to what this complicated series of provisions in this plan, and it's immediately apparent they're totally different. The language that we actually in the court below, the district court, we suggested, put in the CE language. We offered that as a possible remedy. We offer it still now. You heard Mr. Christian offer that. We were told, no, geez, that would have dramatic changes because we're trying to do all kinds of different things here. You have to understand that this plan, how these provisions work together, are substantially different and worse, really, from CE and what was happening in GIT, because not only is a trust being created that plaintiff's lawyers then design the criteria to allow their own claims and value them and then approve them, which I don't know how you could think would generate anything other than more claims than we would have before, and that's evidence we would put on if we had an opportunity to do it. But this case is very different because it also allows the same entity, this claim and control trust, to pass through into the tort system, the California state tort system, claims to be brought anew. I mean, keep in mind, 524G, when Congress brought it about, one of its goals, intentions of Congress, was to stop asbestos litigation, to bring about finality. This plan will not do that. And it will not only not do that, it will cause, we believe, tremendous, tremendous damage to our clients and to the state court system in California. We would like the court outdoors to be open to us so we could present evidence on that. If you look at 5.1.6.
Judge Gould. Counsel?
Yes.
I have a question for you. Same one I asked your colleague. Assuming we held that the insurers were entitled to standing and should have gotten some more process and remanded, what would be the shape and scope of the hearing in the bankruptcy court? You know, would it be to challenge the whole 524 plan, or would it be just to add some provisions to it and so on? In other words, what would you envision if we gave you relief?
We would envision an evidentiary hearing below where we'd have an opportunity to put on evidence to show how these provisions impact us, how they increase our risks and burdens. I think we'd be prepared to suggest alternatives in connection with that hearing that would eliminate or reduce those risks and burdens, with the notion of trying to bring forward possibly a confirmable plan. It's not our goal to be involved in litigation endlessly here. We came forward to the district court.
You don't like this plan.
We don't like this plan, Your Honor. And I think you have to understand what we would be facing in the tort system. You heard some suggestion of this. Imagine this. You have to imagine the real practicality of, we get cases passed through the tort system. These cooperation rights are incredibly important to an insurer. When we need to look and say, who's going to sign a 30B6?
As counsel has indicated, they take on the obligation. And to the extent that they don't live up to the obligation, there are some remedies that you have.
Your Honor, you have to look very closely at how those provisions work together when they say they take on the obligation. First of all, is that illusory in the first place? Imagine the whole notion of us picking up the phone and calling the claimant lawyers and say, we've got our interrogatories to sign this week. Would you mind signing them? Or who are you going to bring to the trial for us? I mean, the whole notion of it is sort of incredible.
But you're saying that inevitably they'd breach their fiduciary duties.
They can't possibly be in any way a real replacement for a company that wants to defend itself.
Okay. Well, we may not reach the end of this entire dispute today, but we have reached the end of the time for argument. So,
thank you, Your Honor.
With that, the matters just argued are submitted, and the court stands adjourned.